Following on Zwani's The Monday Christian, Paul Kim and Sib Subanda have reunited for this exciting new podcast series entitled Why Work, based on Dorothy Sayers' well-known essay by the same title. In this introductory episode, they compare Sayers' World War II context with our post-COVID reality as two watershed moments in the history of work.
Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique contexts on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the Why Work series, hosted by me, Sib Subanda, and my partner in crime from the Monday Christian podcast, Paul Kim. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Sibs. It's good to be back.
This six-part series is based on Dorothy Sayers' well-known essay titled Why Work, which was published in 1942, towards the end of the Second World War. Sayers was one of the first women to complete studies at Oxford University, and alongside contemporaries such as C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton, was a staunch defender of the Christian faith. She died in 1957, aged 64, as a recognized poet, dramatist, amateur theologian and Christian apologist, and is still highly respected as one of the most versatile writers of her generation. In the essay, Sayers presents key biblical reflections on work processed through the lens of wartime Britain. She puts forward three propositions, each with its own set of implications, and in the series, we will unpack these propositions and explore the questions and challenges they raise for us today as we endeavor to engage redemptively in business. I highly recommend that you either read or listen to the full essay. You can find links for both in the show notes. But for the purpose of this podcast, each session will begin with a short reading of the parts of the essay under discussion. Paul, before we listen to today's reading, there may be some of our listeners who are wondering about the approach we're taking for this series. After all, we're talking about an old essay written in Old English during a time in history that very few of us can relate to. So let's start there. Of all the ways we could approach a discussion on redemptive business, why this essay?
Hi, Sibs. That's a fantastic question, because in 2023, that's the year that we're recording this for listeners of the future, it's been many decades since she's written this essay. And we've run a diverse range of experiments related to work across many cultures and countries. And the results are starting to come in or are already in. And I think the world is starting to wake up to the fact that it's not promising. These results are quite concerning. And no one seems to have the right answer. Worse than that, there are some secondary consequences coming out from the way each experiment has looked at work. And there are some serious negative consequences that have come out. So, for example, in some of the more modern countries, population growth has significantly stalled and people don't want to have children anymore. And that is a direct secondary consequence of a poor view of work. And so in this context, it's refreshing to read Dorothy's essay because of her first principles approach to this question. And by first principles, I mean the fundamental concepts or assumptions on which a theory, system, or method is based. And in Dorothy's case, she starts off with her biblical view of work. And we touched on some of this in the Monday Christian podcast series, but she takes it kind of one step further to consider the practical ideals around which we should center our work. So it's not just, you know, work is something that's given to us from God. She puts forward three practical propositions that we can chew through and think through the relevant implications on our work. And it's been fantastic reading, even though the context she's writing it in is the World War II, and she obviously deals with some of the contextual challenges. Her reference back to her North Star, which is biblically based, gives us a lot of food for thought. And then finally, even though it kind of was written in the context of World War II, we do sit with some of the same issues. It's not like those concerns have dissipated as we've become more modern as humankind. But we'll dive into some of that a little bit later on.
Indeed. And C.S. Lewis, who was an advocate of not just listening to the echo chamber, as it were, of your own generation. He's quoted as saying, every age has its own outlook. It is especially good at seeing certain truths and especially liable to make certain mistakes. We all therefore need the books that will correct characteristic mistakes of our own period, and that means the old books. As previously mentioned, Sayers wrote her essay during World War II, and in that context, she feared that after the war, people would abandon their newfound devotion to a larger purpose, namely defeating the Nazis, and return to wasteful consumer spending, being encouraged to do so to keep the demand for labor high. She was concerned that society would lose the intrinsic value of work and return to seeing it primarily as a way to earn money to buy more things. Now, we may not be in the middle of a war, but the COVID pandemic is undoubtedly the first event since the war to devastate lives and economies on a global scale and for a sustained period of time. And it's no secret that just like the war, this period has been a watershed moment in the history of work. Let's get straight to the reading.
I have already, on a previous occasion, spoken at some length on the subject of work and vocation. What I urged then was a thoroughgoing revolution in our whole attitude to work. I asked that it should be looked upon not as a necessary drudgery to be undergone for the purpose of making money, but as a way of life in which the nature of man should find its proper exercise and delight, and so fulfill itself to the glory of God. That it should, in fact, be thought of as a creative activity undertaken for the love of the work itself, and that man, made in God's image, should make things as God makes them, for the sake of doing well a thing that is well worth doing. Unless we do change our whole way of thought about work, I do not think we shall ever escape from the appalling squirrel cage of economic confusion in which we have been madly turning for the last 3 centuries or so, the cage in which we have landed ourselves by acquiescing in a social system based upon envy and avarice. A society in which consumption has to be artificially stimulated in order to keep production going is a society founded on trash and waste, and such a society is a house built upon sand. It is interesting to consider for a moment how our outlook has been forcibly changed for us in the last 12 months by the brutal presence of war. War is a judgment that overtakes societies when they have been living upon ideas that conflict too violently with the laws governing the universe. People who would not revise their ideas voluntarily find themselves compelled to do so by the sheer pressure of the events which these very ideas have served to bring about. Do you realize how we have had to alter our whole scale of values now that we are no longer being urged to consume, but to conserve? We have had to learn the bitter lesson that in all the world there are only 2 sources of real wealth, the fruit of the earth and the labor of men. And to estimate work not by the money it brings to the producer, but by the worth of the thing that is made. The habit of thinking about work as something one does to make money is so ingrained in us that we can scarcely imagine what a revolutionary change it would be to think about it instead, in terms of the work done. To do so would mean taking the attitude of mind we reserve for our unpaid work, our hobbies and our leisure interests, the things we make and do for pleasure, and making that the standard of all our judgments about things and people. We should ask of an enterprise not, will it pay, but, is it good? Of a man, not, what does he make, but, what is his work worth? Of goods, not, can we induce people to buy them, but, are they useful things, well made? Of employment, not, how much a week, but, will it exercise my faculties to the utmost? And shareholders in, let us say, brewing companies, would astonish the directorate by arriving at a shareholders' meeting and demanding to know not merely where the profits go or what dividends are to be paid, not even merely whether the workers' wages are sufficient and the conditions of labour satisfactory,
but loudly and with a proper sense of personal responsibility, what goes into the beer? In war, production for wasteful consumption still goes on, but there is one great difference in the goods produced. None of them is valued for what it will fetch, but only for what it is worth in itself. The gun and the tank, the airplane and the warship have to be the best of their kind. A war consumer does not buy shoddy. He does not buy to sell again. He buys the thing that is good for its purpose, asking nothing of it but that it shall do the job it has to do. Once again, war forces the consumer into a right attitude to the work. And whether by strange coincidence or whether because of some universal law, as soon as nothing is demanded of the thing made but its own integral perfection, its own absolute value, the skill and labor of the worker are fully employed and likewise acquire an absolute value.
So let's kick off the series the same way Sayers kicked off her essay, Paul, by reflecting on the impact of our global disruption, which is COVID, on the way we think about and approach work. And it's a huge topic. Where would you like to start?
Yeah, so we have COVID in the rearview mirror, 3 years since the outbreak, 2020 March-ish in South Africa specifically. And a lot of things have come out, some initial changes to the way we think about work, for example, a huge rise in remote working, and then the slow kind of return to mean as the secondary consequences of this major change has kicked in. And there's so many things that have changed because of COVID. But the two observations I would like to kind of focus in on is, one, the difference between something like COVID and World War II. And the second one is whether some of her concerns that she raised in her essay about a post-World War II environment have come true or not. Starting off with the difference between COVID and World War II, we see something very interesting. As Dorothy says, is expressing what she's observing during World War II and the impact on work. We see that what has happened was a shift of work from one set of industries to another. So it seemed like work was going on in full steam. People were busy working, but obviously it was in the context of contributing to wartime efforts. What's distinct about COVID is that as a global event, it's fascinating because it resulted in the slowing down of work. Many people actually had to put their tools down or were unable to work. And I actually can't think of any other period prior to this where people were so frozen in being able to carry out their work. And so it's a fascinating experiment in terms of the results that came out. And some were really positive, a reflection on what their purpose of their life is, spending more time with family, rest, a reset of rhythms. What was remarkable was what happened in nature. You know, I still remember the one picture that was shared that a city in Nepal or India for the first time in 50 years was able to see the Himalayas from where they were just because of the smog that had arisen from all the industries that were created. And it's a bit of an indictment on humanity that clearly we are having a negative impact on the environment. But at the same time, there was a lot of negative consequences that came from not working. So obviously incomes were disrupted and that affected the financial health of families. Supply chains were severely impacted in that it was brought down to its knees and farmers and related industries had to throw away a lot of their production because they couldn't stop the machine. And the underbelly of our supply chain, the millions of workers who earn very low wages were exposed because they were asked to continue working in spite of what was happening with COVID. So that's the first observation. It's fascinating because COVID meant a lot of people had to stop working. And we could see what happened when the world slows down on its work desires.
Let me just jump in second, because your first point is, you know, this transfer that took place in World War II to other industries. And while I agree with you in that with COVID, there was something of a silence of work. But if you recall, one of the buzzwords in the COVID period was pivot, right? Where people were talking about pivoting from one type of work to another. And certainly what we did see is while there was a slowdown in certain types of work, there was also a surge in other types of businesses and types of work. And we saw people having to reskill and to shift towards the kind of work that could be done online, which in turn had a massive impact on those businesses that were supplying services around online connectivity. So there is some similarity there, wouldn't you say?
Yes and no. And I like the examples that you brought up, but I think the counterpoint I would like to make to your point is that probably because of the rise and the importance of knowledge and skill-based workers, you didn't see that shift happen at the same magnitude and for all peoples compared to what happened in World War II. And so a lot of people couldn't make that shift. We couldn't, as the medical professions and the digital spaces, you couldn't take on a factory worker and not allow them to start to participate in those industries where obviously there was a huge rise in need. So we've created a very difficult or challenging work environments where, you know, fungibility of skill sets or the transferability of skill sets is much harder these days. And so, yes, for some industries, but for the most part, many people couldn't pivot, at least in the earlier periods of COVID.
Yeah, 100%. Your second point had to do with work being valued purely for its short-term economic benefit.
Yeah, so in preparation for this for this podcast series, I went down a very dark path of looking at, you know, what's wrong with the world. And there's so much that's wrong with the world, guys. Don't start if you can't stomach the pain in the world at the moment. Since her time, very much so because of globalization and cheap manufacturing, optionality for the world, China and a lot of the Eastern countries, there's definitely been a flight to cheap. So quality for the most part is now in the domain of the rich. Smartphones every 2 years. Things are very difficult to repair. Three individuals in my context in the last 3 months, all three of them have remarked that their dishwasher or washing machine packed up and the repair cost is almost the same cost as replacing that. Like, how do we get to this point where in society it's actually more worthwhile as individual to buy something new than to repair it? It just creates this culture of waste. And that's a huge problem for us. And so her fears, unfortunately, are grounded in reality post-World War II. We have maybe gone into overdrive in terms of a consumption wastage driven lifestyle for the world. Her concern that intrinsic value of work would be sacrificed at the altar of consumption was clearly justified.
Very good points there. And I just want to explore this idea a bit further because so I'm based in Zim. And one of the ill effects of this loss of value or the intrinsic value of work or valuing work for the work itself rather than what the work can do for you in terms of giving you finances that you can go and buy new dishwashers because yours is broken and all of that sort of thing. One of the ill effects of that I'm seeing in Zim is kind of a wheeler dealer mentality where the question is, the goal is, how do I get money quickly so that I can spend it on the things I want? The question we're not asking is, how do we build good, solid businesses that can contribute meaningfully to the economy and the tax base and provide secure employment? So people are thinking more about what do I need to do to get as much money as I can quickly and far less about building a strong, sustainable economy. Are you seeing this similar sort of trend in South Africa and perhaps other parts of the continent that you've been to?
Yes, and more broadly across the globe, I think this is what we're seeing is a wide variety of symptoms downstream to this fundamental decision we've made as humankind to base our economies on scarcity. Scarcity of skill sets, scarcity of assets, you name it. What happens when scarcity is your fundamental principle that you're going to work around or work on top of is a flight to getting some sort of stability. And in this case, it would be a stability in financial terms. And this is a serious problem. To maybe give two or three examples in the spaces that I play in, entrepreneurs, early stage ventures, investment. A lot of entrepreneurs these days are primarily focused not on what problems they want to solve, but on the problems they want to solve that will create a more convenient source of financial return. How quickly can we scale to and become a big company that generates a lot of money? Or how do we ensure that we get to profitability in 1 year? I recently had a conversation with a senior executive at a tech startup, and he's always wanted to go off on his own. He started to realize this more and more. And the first consideration is, you know, how does he get to 500,000 Rand in sustainable revenue from day one? And now he's looking for a problem to solve. Instead of thinking about the problems that need to be solved and thinking about how to do them financially sustainably, and I'm not saying, you know, you need to be investing for 20 years before you get a financial return, but it should be downstream of the problems we want to tackle that should be tackled in society. And here's the challenge for society as a whole. When your brightest minds are fixated on this way of thinking, then really the people with all the margin in the world who can tackle some of the harder problems are not wanting to do so because they're worried about other objectives. And for him specifically, I mentioned that it's all good and well that you can solve a simpler problem and be financially sustainable. But two things. One, solving a simple problem doesn't give you any traction in terms of solving a harder problem. So, I mean, a silly example is, let's say you wanted to solve a simple problem, starting a tax shop at a school at somewhere like Bishops. You're going to make a lot of money if you get it right. How does that necessarily translate to traction to solving poverty? It doesn't. It may give you oxygen to start tackling the problem, but the longer you wait before you start tackling the problem of poverty, the longer it takes before you get traction in that problem. And the second issue that you sit with is, unfortunately, if you do well with a simpler problem, it's going to suck you in. You're going to want to scale it, and you're going to want to look at a second tax shop and a third tax shop. And you're going to get a false sense of what it takes to solve really hard challenges. And so when you finally start tackling hard challenges, you'll be so used to the feedback loop of solving simple problems, you'll just give up because you don't generate a return in year one. It takes 3 or 4 years before you to see any visible results. And so you get hooked onto this other kind of rat race that you're familiar with and are unable to switch over to solving harder problems. And the last point I want to make is specific in the context of African investment. People coming in to under-resourced infrastructure environments demand a certain rate of return. Without realizing that maybe the problems and the context that you're operating in cannot generate those returns on day one. Maybe down the line, 10, 15 years down the line, you will have infrastructure allow for those rates of return to be generated. But if you go into Africa and all the contextual challenges it has with the what is a return first mindset, it automatically writes off a whole host of problems that will take decades to fix. And again, as a result, we're not making progress on a lot of these challenging problems.
Very interesting listening to you, Paul. And I couldn't help but go back to our early, probably our earliest conversation on Monday Christian, where we started with this whole idea of perspectives and worldviews, because we were talking about how a worldview is what frames your perspective. So your worldview is essentially, how do you answer the big questions of life? And what sort of story is driving the decisions that you make? And so, for example, when it comes to talking about business, when we ask the question, well, what is the purpose of business? That's a worldview question, right? And so someone might ask that, answer that by saying, well, the purpose of business is to make money so that, yeah, I can employ people, but ultimately so that I can get what I want because I've worked hard for it. But the Christian worldview, which as we talked about in the Monday Christian, was really centered around these four pillars or the four chapters of the biblical narrative: creation, fall, redemption, consummation. And the idea that God created everything was good, sin corrupted everything, including business and societal spheres, and that Christ's redemption is something that was accomplished on the cross, but is going to be consummated upon his return. And that we find ourselves in this present age as those who, when we accept Christ, are not just sort of getting a ticket to heaven, but are become participants, if you like, in his redemption project. And so we are a redemptive people, which means that our outlook on life is we are looking for brokenness and looking at how we can minimize brokenness. And so if you're living out of that narrative and you ask the question, what is the role of business in society? It's not just to make money, but it's actually looking at brokenness in society and how business can bring solutions to that. But when we lose the intrinsic value of work, or we're living out of a different narrative, secular narrative, then we get to the place where you've been talking about, where we are not asking the question, how does business solve problems? We are asking the question, how do I make this amount of money? And what do I need to do in order to make that amount of money? Does that ring true?
Yes. And for many Christians, it's not as cynical as making more money, because I think many Christians probably aren't driving themselves to make more money necessarily. It's, how do I sustain my lifestyle? How do I sustain my kids and good desires, kids going to a good education, kids growing up with a big yard? And we're not willing to interrogate whether those things are relevant in this day and age, especially when God has placed us in a context with so many challenges to work on. Going back to your point, I think in that series, we made a case that work is an act of love. And in the case of living in a broken world, loving our neighbor really means loving our enemies and loving those that are marginalized. And so if that is the intrinsic way in which we worship God, then to distill work down to just the financial return to make my lifestyle financially sustainable is a complete perversion of the gift of work that God has given us. And this is where we are today as a society.
Absolutely. And when we sort of step back and think at a more global scale, what would you say we're seeing by way of, you know, the impact of this loss of the intrinsic value of work?
I think I made the case earlier that part of the problem is that we have based our society or the work part of our society on scarcity. And an interesting example to explore the symptoms of this, which leads to two extreme outcomes in the same society, is that of China. So the two phenomenons that are currently taking place at the same time, the one is called lie flat or let it rot. And the whole idea is because your hard work is likely to be unrewarded, it's likely to be unfruitful, kind of echoes of Genesis 3 coming through there. There's no need to exert additional effort than to make enough to sustain yourself, but no more. Verses 996, which means famous, well, I think it was made famous by Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. And so really driving your body into the ground to make a success of it. And the impact of both is scary. So in the lie flat or the let it rot scenario, it's mostly affecting the youth because they're the ones coming onto the job market. They're the ones looking for the opportunity, but there's a scarcity of job opportunities. Like, what happens to the next generation of your society when your 20, 30-year-olds have effectively relegated themselves to a culture of just sustaining themselves? When we all know society requires this surplus to operate, surplus not only in terms of thinking about the next generation, surplus in terms of contributing to taxes and social welfare and all of those things. But if your 20s and 30-year-olds have basically given up, you are on your way to societal destruction. And then secondly, on the other side, on the flip side, this like unrelenting drive towards success and unbridled ambition, driving your people to a 996 kind of working environment, you're definitely seeing lower levels of productivity. You cannot sustain those levels. And to some extent, if you're just measuring 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., people are just going to look busy, but they're not going to be doing the work. Because what's the point? All you have to do is show that you're there between 9 and 9 p.m. Mental health challenges on the rise. Physical health challenges, because at that rate, unless you're 20 or early 30s, your body is going to start packing up. And then you sit with the existential questions, like on the lie flat kind of culture. What's the point of work if hard work doesn't translate into results? And that's the fundamental question around the purpose behind work. On the other extreme, what's the point of all these results if it means that there is no oxygen for the rest of life? And so when you build your economy on scarcity, you create this rat race. And then you fundamentally have two positions toward this rat race. If you are, let's call it, fortunate enough to get into the rat race, it is going to suck you dry because the race never ends. But on the same side, if you can't get into the rat race, you kind of give up, because what's the point? There's no way to progress in life. And that's just a really perverse environment we've set ourselves up for in the world of work.
Yeah, very good points. And I was just listening when you're talking about, you know, asking that question, what is the point of work if it doesn't translate into results? That too is such a worldview question, isn't it? Right? Because we're asking a fundamental question: why do human beings work? Why do we work? Because the lie flat ideology is saying, well, the story I'm living out of says that I work, and in return, I expect certain standard of living. If I cannot, by working, attain that standard of living, what's the point of working, right? And that's a worldview question, and one which I think we'll spend the next couple of sessions exploring. But you can just see how outside of a biblical narrative that gives you a reason to work beyond a certain lifestyle that puts God at the center of the story and not you and what and your ambition, that makes a really big difference. If you don't have that, then it actually is a logical thing to just lie down and let it rot, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And to contrast that, and it's again, kind of leaning towards some of the documentaries I watched. I remember distinctly a couple of street food vendors run by older people. And they explicitly said that, you know, they could have charged more, but they keep their prices low because they want to be able to provide a healthy, warm, nutritious meal to taxi cab drivers or to students at an affordable price, because, you know, that's their, let's call it, calling in life, to be able to food people and to provide generous hospitality in that environment. And as encouraging as it is, what we're also seeing across the globe is a lot of these businesses, the people running it are getting older. And I recently read an article from Japan that there's no one to hand it over to because the younger generation just doesn't have that mindset. So we're seeing millions and millions of businesses around the world, very small businesses, profitable, you know, fundamental building blocks in the communities and their suburbs, with no one to take over because we've trained our youth to seek lifestyle and intellectual stimulation instead of seeking to desire to first to serve others and serve God.
Mm. Well, there's so much more I think we could unpack just on those points, but by way of landing the discussion for today, you've been mulling over this essay, you and I, for a couple of weeks. Are there any personal reflections that you'd like to share?
The kind of two things that I want to share. The one area has been conceptual and the other one a little bit more practical. And starting with the conceptual, since you and I went down the Monday Christian series as we came into it, we were, I suppose, well-versed in this creation mandate thinking, and we got to explore it to a lot of depth and breadth, and it was a lot of fun. But going back to the creation mandate, you know, it's based on Genesis 1:26 to 31. You read all of these initial operating conditions and requirements given to humankind: be fruitful, multiply, have dominion, look after the birds, and all of those things. And I always read them independently of each other. And I'm starting to wonder, perhaps they're supposed to be intertwined, meaning, and we're seeing this in the world today, because there's clearly a way of working that means that we neglect the environment and neglect the animals. There's clearly a way of working that leads to less fruitfulness and less multiplication, meaning that the creation mandate was telling us work, but make sure that you set up your objectives in a way that allow for these three or four pillars to be pursued at the same time. Because if you're not going to set it up from day one to be pursued at the same time, you're going to see that the certain pillars are going to be neglected. And I keep using the population growth example. We've set up our societies chasing lifestyle, chasing career growth in such a way that we're disincentivizing the next generation to have children, to get married, because it's so, so painful to raise children in a modern environment. It's very expensive. You don't get societal support, community support anymore, because you typically moved away from your friendship circles or your family circles, and you're on your own in your walled garden, beautiful, but with no community support. And so there's less and less incentive to have children. So the creation mandate for me is being kind of reframed in my mind as a collective of things that one needs to pursue concurrently. Not pick one over the other, because you get some perverse downstream results.
Well, interesting case study of that is China. They had this experiment with stopping the multiplication, right? So don't multiply, but carry on being fruitful. And I think that's come back to bite them now as they're looking ahead and thinking, oh gosh, we've got this gap in our population. And without the multiplication, how are we going to be fruitful? And so that would seem to suggest that what you're saying is actually true, that those should be seen as taken together.
And it's more frightening than that. As far as I know, there is no known modern society today that has this long-term population decrease set that has been able to reverse it. Japan has been struggling with this from the 1970s already. If I remember correctly, they've tried everything. They have not been able to reverse that. So if you lose, if your society or your culture loses the desire to have marriages and to have kids, raise a family, it will implode by the looks of it. You cannot resurrect that until the repercussions are felt and the next generation decides to have families. But going back to my second reflection point, which is more practical, you know, I had the opportunity to reset about a year ago, go off on my own and establish my structures. And I had the luxury of having hindsight and starting late and observing how different Christian investment organizations have structured themselves. And, you know, I thought what I did was kind of the best of breed thinking, learning off the learnings of others. And so what I did was I set up a group holding structure, and the two owners of this group, well, the one is a PBO, which owns the economic shares, and the family trust, which owns the voting shares. And that was my kind of personal desire to split out the economic upside from influencing the organization. I don't trust myself with the economic wealth, so you know, structure it correctly from day one.
But what, for those outside South Africa, PBO is a public benefit organization, right?
Yes, yes. And, you know, with the money, I wanted to do things that typically you can't solve through business, and therefore you do need to support it. Elderly, in our case, it would have been education, things in medical, and so on and so forth, ministry. But because of this essay, I'm starting to change my perspective on this. Here's the thinking, right? Charity is not a long-term solution. They are typically stopgap solutions. Giving money every year to charity and committing to it means that we are committed to temporary solutions. Now, the extent of these commitments is the extent to which we force ourselves to remain dependent on short-term solutions. And so how much oxygen in all respects, not only financial, because my attention will go there, my time will go there, my social capital will go there, Are these commitments taking from genuine, innovative, redemptive efforts to solve real challenges in society because we're happy with the Band-Aid and we consistently fund the Band-Aid? So where my thinking is at the moment is to, well, what if the true nature of our work as a group is to be more risk-seeking with the types of businesses we want to start and fund over time? How do we become more willing to risk our capital and our social networks to go into harder and harder problems and to create redemptive businesses there? Then the question becomes, then what do you do on the charitable side? Because the reality is, you know, there are certain areas that we do need charity. And my thinking has changed there as well to say, as an organization, we won't fund charities. As an organization, we will make it desirable and convenient for humans to get involved with charities. So how do we create an ecosystem and a culture amongst all the portfolio companies and their founders and their employees and their suppliers to want to get involved individually in some of the charities that we want to support? So humans getting involved in charities and not organizations, at least not from a funding perspective. And that's kind of where I'm thinking at the moment, what I'm thinking at the moment. And I'm hoping the next 6 weeks of thinking through Dorothy Says essay will help me make a final decision.
That's very insightful, Paul. And I think just very encouraging as well. And I think to our listeners, so all of these reflections for Paul have come as he's been reading this essay. And I just want to, as we come draw to the end of this session, just to encourage you not to just read the essay or listen to it as an intellectual exercise, but actually trust God to speak to you. Because what Paul has just shared now, this is not rules for Christian businesses on how to set up, you know, charitable trust. This is just how God has been speaking to him and challenging him as he's engaged with the content. So I really want to encourage you to take the time to do that for yourself. But for now, we're going to have to end it there. And Paul, if this first session is anything to go by, I think we're in for a very exciting few weeks. To our listeners, we'd love for you to join in the discussion by dropping me an email at sibs@mergon.co.za. Just share your thoughts and questions, because towards the end of the series, we're going to invite a couple of you to join us on the podcast and share those thoughts. And we'll have a crack as well at answering some of your questions. But for now, thank you for listening in. We'll catch you in the next session as we explore Sayer's first proposition, which is that work is not primarily a thing one does to live, but the thing one lives to do. God bless.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partnered together to live up their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.